On this week's Brewbound podcast, we have Three Weavers co-founder Lynn Weaver, who discusses the company's sale to the Canarchy Craft Brewery Collective, opportunities to grow craft beer sales in Los Angeles, building a brand on-premise, and her thoughts on the future of the category. We've also got a roundup of the latest news items from the last week and some segments. But before we get to that, we wanted to tell you all about Brewbound Live, our two-day conference for professionals in the beer, cider, and flavored malt beverage industries. The event is taking place at the Lowe's Hotel on November 27th and 28th in Santa Monica, California. It will bring together a diverse group of thought leaders and entrepreneurs, including the aforementioned Lynn Weaver, to discuss trends, challenges, and the future of the brewing industry. In addition to learning from the founders and leaders of breweries large and small, Brewbound Live will also feature discussions with cannabis entrepreneurs, the latest trends from the independent retail channel, consumer insights from Nielsen, and the findings of a $200,000 C-store research project conducted by Anheuser-Busch. Brewbound Live is also a great opportunity to engage with fellow industry professionals who are interested in sharing ideas and discussing ways to move the category forward. We'll have a variety of networking opportunities throughout the two-day event, so plan to come to Santa Monica for a few days so you can take full advantage of the program we've put together. We hope you can join us in November, and to register for the event, visit brewboundlive.com. That's brewboundlive.com. Okay, let's go. Welcome to episode 5 of the Brewbound podcast presented by BevNet, where we bring you interviews with some of the most well-known figures throughout the beer industry. Today is Thursday, October 11th, and my name is Chris Frenari, the editor of Brewbound. I'm joined by my co-host, fellow Brewbound editor Justin Kendall. We've got a bunch of news to bring you this week and, of course, our interview with Lynn Weaver, so let's jump right in. The biggest news this week is coming from Craft Brew Alliance, which just yesterday announced the acquisition of its three quote-unquote partner brands, Cisco Brewers out of Nantucket, Wynwood Brewing out of Miami, and Appalachian Mountain Brewery out of North Carolina. CBA had previously negotiated distribution and contract brewing partnerships with AMB and Cisco, and it already owned 24.5% of Wynwood. That was a stake that it acquired for $2.1 million back in December of 2016. The company is not disclosing the financial terms of the AMB and Wynwood purchases, but we are able to report that it will acquire Cisco for about $23 million. All three deals were financed through a new $45 million revolving line of credit with CBA's lender, Bank of America. And we know that the total cost to acquire all three brands will be less than that. So the line of credit will also be used to fund operations and strategic growth initiatives. It's unclear exactly how much will be spent on the purchases of AMB and Wynwood, but we know that both of those brands produced around 10,000 barrels annually, according to CBA Chief Andy Thomas. And I would say that it's directionally accurate to speculate that the cost to acquire those brands falls somewhere in the $700 to $1,000 per barrel range. So on the low end, we're looking at about an additional $12 million, and on the high end, around $17 million combined for both brands. I personally think it's probably closer to the $12 million figure, which leaves about $10 million or so for CBA to reinvest into its operations.
Chris, do you have a sense of how much of CBA's portfolio these brands will make up now?
Yeah, so collectively, these brands are going to account for about 8 to 10% of CBA's businesses, or of CBA's business, I should say. And the purchases come at a time when its other regional plays, Red Hook and Widmer, are really struggling. The other piece of the business that is driving growth for CBA is Kona. So I think this is a pretty smart move for CBA. CBA now has brands that play pretty well in Oregon, Washington, California with Kona, obviously Hawaii, Florida, North Carolina, and Massachusetts. So just in those states alone, there are roughly, 90 million people or so, which is about 27% of the country's population. And if you figure that about 75% of those people are over the age of 21, give or take, you're looking at about access to around 67 million people with a quote-unquote local brand.
Speaking of acquisitions with a local focus, two small breweries are in the midst of a merger in Michigan. Roke Brewing is acquiring Right Brain Brewery. It's not quite a done deal yet, as it's expected to close in the next 3 months or so. I spoke with Roque Brewing co-owner and CEO John Leone, who told me that joining forces gives both breweries the critical mass they need to compete with larger beer companies. Leone also told me that they're open to tie-ups with other breweries, so this is likely only the beginning for them.
I think we'll see more acquisitions of this kind. What else happened this week?
Lots of taproom news this week, too. Russian River is officially opening its $40 million brewery and restaurant in Windsor, California. Russian River first announced plans for the new brewery in May 2016, broke ground a year later, and they finally opened the doors this week with 60,000 barrels of capacity. In Eugene, Oregon, Ninkasi is spending up to $1 million to convert an office building into a 4,000-square-foot tasting room that also serves food. Ninkasi currently operates a 700-square-foot taproom, so this is obviously a big jump for them. But according to the Register Guard, Ninkasi's production has increased since they started canning their beer. And in Florida, Constellation Brands-owned Funky Buddha has inked a 3-year deal with the NHL's Florida Panthers to put an 80-foot taproom inside the main lobby of the arena. It opened today for the second home game of the season. Funky Buddha is also brewing a New England-style IPA called Gloves Off for the Panthers' 25th anniversary.
Well, I think we're going to have to rename this podcast the Taproom Podcast, because we are talking about taprooms. It just seems like every episode now. And, you know, a lot is happening, as always, out there in beer world. For more on these stories, hit the site brewbound.com to learn more. We've got our in-depth interview with Andy Thomas and a whole bunch of insight into CBA's newly acquired brands, two of which, AMB and Wynwood, actually got introduced to CBA through our very own Startup Brewery Challenge, which we've since rebranded to the Pitch Slam. But it's really cool to see those relationships evolve to the point that they have. And, you know, it's, I guess, kind of neat to have played a pretty small role in all that.
That's very cool.
And with that, let's get to our interview with Lynn Weaver, the founder of LA's Three Weavers Brewing Company. In July, Three Weavers, quote-unquote, bought into the Canarchy Craft Brewery Collective, which is backed by private equity firm Fireman Capital Partners, and includes Oscar Blues Brewery, Perrin Brewing Company, Cigar City Brewing, Squatters Craft Beer, and Wasatch Brewery, which collectively are known as the Utah Brewers Cooperative, and Texas's Deep Ellum Brewing Company. As part of the deal, Lynn, along with about a dozen or so investors, exchanged their equity in Three Weavers for shares of the larger Canarchy entity. And we had a chance to catch up with Lynn Weaver during the 2018 Great American Beer Festival to chat about the early days of her partnership with Canarchy. It's still fresh. What it's like selling beer in the LA market and how she expects the craft category to evolve in the coming years. So here she is, Lynn Weaver.
This is Justin Kendall, assistant editor of Brewbound, and I'm here with my colleague, Chris Fernari, and we're joined today at the Great American Beer Festival with the founder of Three Weavers, Lynn Weaver. Thanks for joining us, Lynn.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it's great to be here in Denver, Colorado, and drinking all the wonderful beers at the GABF. You having fun?
I'm having a great time.
Nice.
It's awesome.
Awesome. So, I mean, obviously, I think the sort of burning question on everybody's mind is, how are things going with Canarchy? It's been a few months since the deal. What have you learned?
I'm not sure on podcast land, but it's fucking rad. So I'm having a great time. It's been really refreshing to feel like I'm not on an island by myself anymore, and that I have like a really solid team to be able to bounce business strategy, ideas, opportunities, and be able to place them in the right places. It's really one of those things in which craft beer drinkers don't know about, the struggles and how hard it is actually to start a brewery, and how challenging and also how emotionally draining and stressful it can be. So it's nice to have a little bit of that stress kind of taken off of my shoulders.
Yeah, maybe let's actually talk a little bit about that process of starting the brewery for listeners who aren't as familiar with Three Weavers and who you are. You know, give us sort of the Cliff's Notes version of your story, your entrepreneurial story.
Sure. So we started out in June of 2013. I was a home brewer prior and was really looking to figure out what my next career was going to be. I was at home with my kids at that point in time. Left a background in finance prior to raise my kids, who, you know, make up Three Weavers. But ultimately, it was really kind of like finding that next career where I wanted to go and something that I could really have hands-on on. I realized really early on that no amount of homebrewing personally for me justified me being on the brew deck. And I was lucky enough to meet up with Alexandra Noel, who's a phenomenal brewer, and make her our brewmaster. And we've been working together since then. One of the reasons why I chose craft beer versus any other industry was really because of the community and that culture that you just can't find anywhere else. Although I did mention earlier that I felt like I'm on an island, we're all on islands, and all these islands are very close together, but at the same point, you're surrounded by water, and how deep that water is around you is going to be dependent on how much risk you take on, essentially. But at the same point, there is a swim between each island, and you only get so much out of that, right? I think that we were at a point where I saw, you know, kind of like where there was a shift in the industry as a whole, where I didn't want to be by ourselves anymore, and that it made more sense, like you said earlier, what was it? It was at California Craft Brewers Association, where it was better not to be on the island anymore, but in a submarine. And maybe it's called a Canarchy submarine, but at least we're weathering the tide and the storms of whatever may be coming, but at least it's calmer and more methodical, and being able to bounce ideas and strategies and just resources across the board.
When you realized that you didn't want to be on an island by yourself, how did you sort of get into, you know, looking for partners?
It was when Patrick Rue from the brewery made their transaction, I think it was over 2 years ago, that was one of the really defining moments for me. I literally freaked out. I freaked out because I didn't know the parameters of his deal or anything like that. And it was one of those moments where, you know, we have small other investors, and can that group of people possibly have a coup in some sense and, you know, change the direction of the company ultimately. Even if I had ownership like that was majority or whatever, I don't want to be with a group of people who wanted me to do something else because of dollars, right? I want to be with a group of people who believe in what I believe in, who believe in what Three Weaver stands for. And it was really important. And so when Patrick moved forward with his transaction, it really rattled me, and I actually was able to have some time with him and kind of talk through his reasoning and why. And then the third quarter numbers came out, and they weren't great. It was very frightening at that point in time, like in 2017, where you saw, like at the end of third quarter, all these double-digit regional and national brands that were really down. And then there were indicators in 2000, like towards the end of 2017, fourth quarter numbers were still not improving. And so that's when I was like, you know what? This is now the time to actually kind of really dig deep into that strategic partner and what that really meant to me. Even though I had already started that conversation with all of our investors, like, hey, you know, we need to possibly consider a strategic if we really want to take advantage of any opportunities that really come to us. So I took some time to talk with our attorney, our outside counsel, Kyle Leingang, and he was amazing. He's just like the rock in the sense of all business strategy for us. And he's a really good friend too. And he was able to give me all of those options of, if you go down this way, this is how it's going to be. Here are the probabilities of this one. And here's XYZ, whatever it might be. And then we ran down like all what was available or out there and where he thought we would fit best. And literally it came down to like one name, and it was Canarchy. And he happened to have met Matt Frazier on a panel, and he reached out to him, didn't tell him who it was, but just where we were located, and then he was peaked, and then that's kind of like where the history is.
Yeah, the rest is history, as they say, right? Mm-hmm. So let's take a couple steps back. You talked a lot about your investor group, and I guess wanting to keep them sort of happy and engaged in the business and making sure that obviously you return their investment to them is you know, part of the goal of any entrepreneur who starts a business. Maybe talk to our listeners about the process of identifying your early investors and that fundraising process. And then when it came time to execute a transaction, how you started having that conversation with your, you know, your original investors.
So all of our investors were friends and families, you know, my circle. So I would never allow anybody to invest in Three Weavers who I didn't know personally. But it gets to a point where you can only tap so much money out of your friends and family. The circle is only so deep.
Yeah.
it was always understood that I'm going to take this as far as I possibly could, that it was always a passionate investment, that you should never expect any type of return. And if I do, then you believe in what I'm capable of doing. And that was kind of like the message that I always shared with them, and they believed in.
Yeah.
They invested because they believed in me and they loved craft beer. That is the reason why. And if they were able to partake in some enjoyment of coming to the brewery and enjoying like being a part of something in which a lot of folks aren't able to be a part of, then that's rad. And I was able to do that. Moving forward, when some of these partnerships or like just opportunities came to us, they got much more substantial and not necessarily risky, but the reward on it was very high, but the dollars required were very high as well. And that's when you kind of go, ooh, I can't do this by myself. My pockets are not deep enough, but I don't want to miss out on these opportunities because it will ultimately, at the end of the day, affect craft beer in a negative manner if I actually allow, like, say, the Constellations or, you know, the ABs or the Millers or whatever come into that space, which is our home territory, and stick a flag saying that they're craft beer when they're not.
Right.
So that's when, you know, I mentioned a little bit in our prior interview, like, you know what, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. It's like, look, I'm going to defend craft as much as I possibly can. And if you judge me because I'm doing it in a manner which is going to be the fastest and the way that I feel is right to prevent infiltration of non-craft brands into certain areas which, you know, are considered our home territory, then fine, judge me. But you know what? At the end of the day, I prevented something big from happening. And what will happen is that everybody else in my community, all 70-plus breweries within the LA Brewers Guild, will be better off because of it.
Yeah.
So I'm all for that.
So when you're going through those options, that was something that you completely ruled out?
The AB Constellation, yeah. Yeah, I can't sell my soul. Sorry.
Well, I don't think Dale Katechis would like it if you sold your soul
either.
No,
Dale's awesome. He's rad.
Being the sole founder that he is.
Yeah, yep. He's got the biggest heart.
So it sounds like, you know, these opportunities that you were talking about were sort of growth opportunities, and it was the decision between, you know, 2Xing or 3Xing the business and the cost that it would take to do that.
No, they're brand opportunities.
Okay.
I'm going to say that they're brand opportunities because there's two things. When you're looking at growth, you're going to look at points of distribution and rate of sale. That's growth. Brand impressions will drive that rate of sale ultimately at the end of the day. The more impressions that you can make on a consumer will have a direct effect on your rate of sale. That's why marketing is so important.
Mm-hmm.
That's why that Budweiser and Miller Coors, all these guys spend so much money on marketing because it drives rate of sale. It may not necessarily drive the points of distribution, but ultimately rate of sale and points of distribution have like this hand-in-hand relationship. And so if you're in a place in which you're able to have a massive amount of brand recognition and that you're able to kind of like really define your space, that's really important.
Yeah.
It's really important.
Absolutely. Now, you're based in Inglewood, so you're in Southern California, in L.A. What's it like selling beer in a market like L.A., which, you know, we've been told is sort of dominated now by a lot of the import brands, the Mexican import brands. I know that a brand like Kona does quite well there. What's it like trying to sell beer in L.A.? And L.A. as a market in general is just kind of getting going for craft.
It is just, it's been going for a little bit, but it just had a disadvantage in the sense of its start, I would say. It was just late to the game.
Yeah.
And so I don't know the most recent numbers of the percentage of craft, but when you go from 8 to 16, which was in 2017, I think, the 2016 numbers were, I think, were 16% craft sold in chain. That's great. I mean, that was from 2012 to 2017, a five-year period of time, and you're gaining, you know, a substantial amount of market, if not doubling it. That's fantastic. The difference is that, you know, San Diego is still continuing to gain faster than we are. But that's okay. When you look at the overall numbers and percentages, Los Angeles is huge, absolutely huge. If you look at the dollars that are actually spent on beer in Los Angeles, they're huge. I'm hoping that nobody comes into LA, but like sincerely, it's a great market and the breweries that have opened there, I think find success, be it a smaller tap room kind of model or even a production facility. I think they all have their place and there's still opportunity. So, I mean, like when I look at LA, I'm like, you know, there are people who don't even know who Three Weavers is, which is fine because that just tells me, I don't look at it as like, oh shit, they don't know who Three Weavers is. It's going to be like one more person to like turn to the other side. The other thing too is like, when you look at Inglewood, everybody makes the assumption that it's actually predominantly African-American. It's not. It's Latino. And I think that as time goes along, every generation within like any social economic demographic will have their new thing or like their flavor or whatever culture that they apply to their upbringing or the melding pot in a sense. And LA is just like that. And so I think that LA is still trying to find its groove in the sense of what they want. Right. And so right now we're kind of doing the IPAs, the hazy IPAs, the brutes, you know, and some folks are throwing out the Mexican lager. I think that there's a lot of opportunity there to explore. But I think that all of the breweries that are out there have a duty to be able to kind of be innovative to find out what that style is going to end up being, because I don't think it's known yet. And whoever figures it out is going to do very, very well in the county.
Yeah.
On top of that, you see those trends happening, you know, the hazy IPAs, the brewed IPAs, the Mexican lagers. How do you sort of engage in that while still sort of staying authentic or, you know, true to the ethos of what you see Three Weavers as?
So we're not trend followers. Alex always says, you know, I want to be a trendsetter, not a trend follower, right? And so we've been very much clear beer, unless it's a Keller and it's meant to be that way. Prior to, you know, all the hazy stuff and everything, we're just not a hazy brewery. But I will say this, is that she makes an incredible brute IPA. And that's where she is creative and she runs and does an incredible job. She just does all these different collaborations across the world where you're exposed to different styles and different methods. And it just gets incorporated into some incredible different beers that a lot of people just haven't tried before. So when you ask me about innovation, being exposed to different cultures and countries and that travel aspect is really important because it gives that creativeness a new perspective, a new way of looking at something.
Do you think when some of those larger craft brands jump on a trend like a hazy IPA, do you think that sort of strips away the specialness that, you know, some of the smaller craft brewers who've been making those styles and sort of, you know, were at the forefront of it, do you think it takes away some of that specialness from them?
I'm going to say no. The reason why is because the innovation side, and I'll be like specific to like, say, Sierra Nevada. They are incredible. That team at Sierra Nevada, Ken Grossman, all of them have such an innovation within their bones that what they're doing there on the quality side is just something that we can never, like we can't unless we had the dollars to be able to do that, right? And so I respect them deeply because of that. And they probably will come out with something that's going to be incredible upcoming that nobody else is thinking of. And then everybody else is going to be jumping on that bandwagon. So I don't think it cheapens it in any way or makes it harder. I think that maybe it would make somebody aspire, you know? I mean, my favorite beer in college was Sierra Nevada Pale Ale. It's inspired so many people. I bet you anything, 60% of the folks upstairs right now were inspired by Pale Ale. So no, I don't think that people have forgotten their roots.
Yeah. So you talked earlier about not wanting to be on an island by yourself and, you know, wanting to link up with a group like Canarchy that provides a little bit of protection and a little bit of support. Where do you see everything going over the next couple of years now that we're approaching 7,000 craft breweries in the US? Like, where's craft headed?
That's a good question. And I'm going to flip it on you after. Well, I want to hear where you think it's going. You know, as I kind of look back at what Bart Watson talks about a lot, I don't know if you have any background in economics, but we're actually in an industry that is very healthy right now. When you look at an industry as a whole, it goes through a natural economic cycle. Okay. So we went through that growth, which was crazy, and that growth stage is going to end up having that double-digit growth rate and everything like that. And then you have this maturation or mature stage where it starts going between 4 and 6%, and we're at 5.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. I'll tell you right now, we're beating the GDP, which is great.
Yeah.
Anytime you're beating the GDP, you're doing great.
So okay? You pay attention to that stuff.
Absolutely, I do. It's unfortunate that obviously, growth from anywhere has to be taken from somewhere.
Right.
unless there's a swing in consumer demand, right? So what I'm taking in my growth is going to be coming from somewhere. I recognize that. Ultimately, at the end of the day, it has to average out to 5%. So my growth rate of 70%, where we're at right now, ultimately has to be coming from somewhere because the average is at 5%. I get that. But at the same point, that means that somebody else is way below 5%. And the question becomes, is like, what are they doing? Are they stagnant? Are they trying to innovate? You know, do they have their sales team? There's like a lot of questions. Are they letting it just go? If you're not on it now, to be honest, you're behind the ball, right? You're not in front of it. Like Matt said, you're not looking where the puck's going. You're like skating after it or skating where the puck is, and the puck's already moved and you're like standing there and going, where'd the puck go? It's like, well, it's way down there because you aren't paying attention, right? So economically speaking, we're in a good space in this industry and I'm super happy about it. I'm not worried about it. And I don't think most investors are worried about it. As long as you're in, you're working with a brewery that's on the other side, like in the sense of above 5% or more, I would say.
So your growth, do you think, is coming at the expense of other larger, you know, regional players that we see are, you know, down 8% or 10% or whatever it
is? I do. Yeah. We're predominantly on draft right now. I think in 2017, we were at 85% draft.
Wow.
You know, we have a huge amount of white space on the chain side, and we haven't even opened it up yet. And we were only in Southern California. We did export a little bit, but that was it. So it was predominantly in Southern California. It was LA County, Orange County, San Diego. And that was predominantly draft. And now we're moving forward into more chain placements, hopefully in spring, and moving up into Northern California, which I'm super excited about, and even just Central California. So all of those opportunities will end up driving an even faster growth rate, right? But I'm really looking forward to the chain side. I want to be able to go into Ralph's and, you know, pick up a six-pack of Expatriate.
Justin, I think we found the brewery that is taking all these tap handles. It's Three Weavers. 85% of your mix is on draft. I mean, this is the reason why a Sierra Nevada Pale Ale or any of these other, like, you know, long-standing stalwart flagship brands are struggling on-premise, right? Because of the locals?
We were a topic of conversation in a lot of ABP meetings last year. Like, yeah, so what about those Three Weavers? How are they doing for you? And it's like, great. You know, it's one of those things where I felt very, both Alex and I felt very passionate about that on-premise was really important, because if you didn't have brand recognition, going back to impressions, right? We talked about this earlier, is that those impressions are super important, because if they don't know your brand, why the hell would they pull you off the shelf?
Right.
So we were heavy into draft. 50% of it, I would say, is that we weren't ready to go into package. Alex has very strict guidelines in the sense of quality. And if we couldn't package it in a manner that would prevent oxygen pickup, then we weren't going to do it. And so we didn't. And until we could actually provide enough beer to support that avenue, we weren't going to do it.
Did maintaining such a focus on the draft to start, on the draft piece of the business, did that enable you to, I guess, sort of lower the cost of selling beer? Because we hear so much about the importance of having feet on the street. And while that's definitely important for the on-premise world, no doubt, like, a lot of it really is the chain business and having those salespeople work in the chains and work in the off-premise really hard, where it is the most competitive. So were you able to kind of sneak in and fly in under the radar and do so with, you know, having to invest a little bit less up front?
So the way I look at our sales team, it was a pre-spend. You got to pre-seed the market before you're going to own the market. It's kind of like that adage where you never should put the cart before the horse, where I'm like, well, in sales and in beer, you put the cart before the horse. If you have a down skew that's not doing well, well, then you need to spend money to actually get it back up. So that is something that's very different within what I've learned, at least within the craft beer space or just in beer in general, to just, you know, kind of revamp or revigorate a brand. When you're talking about the chain side of things, what's really great about Canarchy is that they have, although we had a chain person, she is now integrated into the Canarchy side of things. And she's taking everything that all of her relationships for Southern California and applying it to across the board. Whereas they had Northern California and all this other stuff. And that guy can take on ours and learn our story. I mean, it's not going to happen overnight. Don't get me wrong. But at the same point, the dollar spend is a lot less because now it's taking that distributor mentality but on a craft level.
Yeah.
Right? And then you just don't have the spend anymore. So there's certain ideas and ways of being able to be cost effective and be able to win rather than not. But as a small brewery, yes, feet on the street are super important. We had a lot of feet on the street. We probably had 4 or 5 sales reps as we kind of continue to grow.
And those were folks that were primarily focused on the draft business.
Pretty much, yeah, except for like Whole Foods or like Total Wine or something along those lines.
Yeah.
Or independents, yeah.
So moving into the chain business, how has Canarchy sort of helped you, you know, evolve into that?
It's just been a connection that wasn't there before, a relationship that we hadn't forged. It's the easier access to be able to have a conversation versus having that middle person who's blocking constantly to be able to make something happen. It's a big deal. Something that I don't know if anybody else is seeing this or not, or like pre-see this as a future, but in Florida, where AB pretty much blocked out a bunch of craft breweries in resets, I mean, those breweries are having to lay off people now. And I think that that's probably going to end up being a strategy that AB is going to be taking on across the states.
Yeah.
And it freaks me out. But then at the same point, I'm just like, okay, well, you know what? I think Canarchy's strong enough with their presence across the board that I don't have to worry about that when it comes to California. But those set captains are issues that I think they're massive and that need to be addressed because they're totally antitrust. Or else, like, at least establish a craft captain.
Right.
Saying, like, here is what the craft is going to be. And then have somebody who is craft, like Sierra or, you know, whatever region it might be. Maybe Bell's or whatever. My point is, it's really simple. It's like, you can't have somebody blocking other brands out. That's just simply antitrust. You know, you have to have equal access to market, and it's just not that way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was going to be sort of my next question is, how does independent craft maintain its seat at the table when you do have, you know, the larger companies now that have their portfolios of brands, and it's sort of one-stop shop for a retailer. If they want to fill out their set with 10 different AB brands and, you know, 3 different Constellation brands and 3 different Miller Coors brands, they can do that.
Yeah, you ask any of the big national brands, they'll say that they don't have a seat at the table. That when they are presenting, that Anheuser-Busch is sitting at the table. Like when they're sharing their deck or whatever, their spend plans for that whatever chain it might be. Ask them and you will find out that craft does not have a seat at the table, which is totally messed up.
So how do you get a seat at the table then?
It's a really good point. I think that the idea of actually having like a craft captain would be amazing. Will that happen? I don't know.
At the same time, it would seem that being involved with a Canarchy would give you a leg up on a lot of other craft breweries out there in these type of situations.
I agree with you. And not to a fault. I made my decisions because of how I felt within the market and how I look at my leverage position and the risk that I'm taking on and the fact that I have a family and that I have employees and my responsibility to all of them as well, okay? And my goal is for Three Weavers to be here for a very long period of time. And my concern is that if, you know, the shit hits the fan and in 5 years, it's like really bad, I didn't want to have to lay off people who have dedicated so much time, energy, and loyalty to me and to Alex and to our brand, and I would feel awful about that.
Yeah. Well, we've seen that from a lot of different breweries. I mean, it's run the gamut. I mean, it's the full spectrum from, you know, the largest beer company in the world, Anheuser-Busch, laying off hundreds of people to Miller Coors. And then, you know, anecdotally, I've heard that it's happening, you know, even at the way far back end of the long tail. Like, you know, 5,000 barrel breweries are laying a couple salespeople off and reallocating those dollars towards marketing because they think that, you know, that those dollars are going to go further than having another salesperson in the market that's beating down a retailer and they're the 15th person in line that beat them down that day, right?
Or they're laying off because they need to get cash positive.
I guess sort of one final question for you. I mean, as you start to kind of think about everything that we've discussed, the, you know, competitiveness and the challenges that the category is facing, this misunderstanding of financial planning and valuation assessment, and just kind of where you think the market is heading in general, what would be sort of your advice to other entrepreneurs out there that are trying to make sense of everything?
So is this towards people who are looking to start a brewery or those who already started a brewery?
Those that have already gotten in, you know, one of the 7,000 that exist
now. Yeah, so I would say twofold. Number one is understand your numbers. Okay, understand your profit margins, your EBITDA, all of those items. It's really important. There was a gentleman, I can't remember his name right now, Lou. I think it was Lou. Anyways, he was the CPA at the financial planning seminar that has this Excel spreadsheet that helps you determine what your growth rate actually can support, like the dollars you generate, like how much of a growth rate you can support. And what we kind of determined was is that you can't grow any faster than 25% without putting money in. Your revenue stream can only support like a 25% growth rate. So anybody who's growing faster than that, that's a smaller brewery, is putting money in. They have to because there's just no other way of doing it. Okay, so like for me, it's like I'm constantly feeding three weavers. I was feeding three weavers because I wanted to make sure that we were maintaining our market share and all that good stuff. And that was my choice, right? But at the end of the day, when you're looking at starting a brewery or else like maintaining the brewery that you have, do what you think it's going to ultimately be successful and do not inflate your numbers. Be realistic. Be conservative. Cut things in half in the sense of what you think your revenue is, and are you going to still make it?
Yeah.
Because, you know what? You need to take a paycheck at some point, right? You're not going to be able to, like, go and continue to just grow. And if it ended up being, like, the tasting room model that Sam was from Dogfish Head was talking about, fantastic. Do it. Make awesome beer. Make awesome beer, know your numbers, and make sure that you're being realistic. Because I think that there are a lot of folks out there who have business plans that are not.
Yeah.
A few starry-eyed people out there.
That's okay. Dreams are big, you know, but be realistic. I'm not going to say don't go after it, but at the same point, recognize that there are a lot of breweries opening or scheduled to open. I think Bart was saying that between 300 and 500 are going to close this year. And an offhand comment, somebody asked him what 2019 was going to be. He's like, 1,000?
That seems high. I mean, we had heard 200 to 300 closing in...
this year.
Yeah.
I'm talking about next year.
Oh, 300 to 500 in 2019, you think?
Well,
yeah, I
we'll
think
see.
He did say like 300 to 500.
Well, then he's being conservative.
In the next couple of years, he said it's going to pretty much
level out.
Even out.
Yeah.
Really? Oh, that's fascinating.
I would imagine that those lines have to meet at some point. I mean, if there's 2,000 in planning, you know, and we're opening 1,000 per year, like at some point, the amount of closures, people are going to just give up and people are going to decide that it's not for them. People are going to find themselves in distress situations. There's going to be all sorts of different ways that it contributes to the number, right?
Yeah. And then people are going to look at the industry as a whole and go, not so great anymore. I'm not going to give you any money.
Yeah. And that's going to have ramifications
Absolutely.
On all the other businesses for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, man, it's going to be an interesting industry to cover for the next couple of years and probably more interesting for you to be involved in.
I'm looking forward to not like the crappy part of it, but I'm looking forward to seeing how it evolves. Like I said before, we're actually in a very healthy space. It's just ultimately there's going to be consolidation and closure. That's just where we are in the market space right now, like in our cycle. It's a natural progression that that's going to happen. And if anybody looks it up, I mean, like you look at an economic cycle of an industry and you will see where we are. It's not that hard. It's basic economics. It's a natural progression. Every single industry goes through it. Some are longer, some are, you know, shorter. Some cycles actually take a little bit longer, but it is a cycle. You can easily see it.
Yeah. Who would have thunk that the beer industry wouldn't defy the laws of economics?
It's baffling, really. I mean, never would have guessed.
It doesn't defy the laws of biochemistry either, so it's not going to change economics.
Oh, well, Lynn, this has been great. We won't keep you from getting to your booth and pouring some beers
for thanks, guys.
All
always.
The thousands of people here at the Great American Beer
you know,
Fest.
I always love hanging out with you, too.
Yeah, it's been great getting to know you, and it's been great picking your brain over the last year or so, and good luck out there.
Thank you. You got to come by.
We will.
Definitely will.
All right, cheers.
Cheers.
Bye.
All right, that was our interview with Lynn Weaver. A lot of great stuff from Lynn, and you can just feel the passion that she has for craft and the Three Weavers business. Justin, now that we've had a couple of weeks to chew on some of the stuff that she mentioned, what sticks out to you?
What sticks out to me the most is, yes, she is passionate, but it really stood out that she didn't want to be on an island by herself. that this was a moment in time that she noticed she needed help. And she wasn't going to make it through possibly without that help. And how rocked she was, too, by the brewery transaction that sort of set this in motion. That really stuck out.
Yeah, I didn't really expect to hear that from her, because at the time that the brewery transaction was announced, and that's the brewery, B-R-U-E-R-Y, not just any old brewery, it didn't really create that much of a wave throughout the craft beer industry. I mean, it was a, you know, sort of unheard of private equity firm that had invested in them, and it seemed, I guess, sort of natural to me, but that thing really struck a chord with her.
It really did, and that, like you said, that was very surprising to hear, and to hear that it really set this chain of events into motion for her, where she's seeing growth is slowing. She wants to find a strategic partner, and she actively starts going to look, because she doesn't want to end up with investors, you know, forcing her hand to do something she doesn't want to do.
Yeah, I guess it's always going to be, you know, something different for everyone, and I would bet that there are other entrepreneurs who have had similar experiences, whether it was the Ballast Point transaction or Firestone Walker or Golden Road or, you know, any a number of transactions that have occurred. Somebody else probably looked at it and said, oh, gee, like maybe I should do something too. And I guess it was the brewery for her. But we talked about just her passion for the business, and that'll really only kind of carry you so far. And I think that's ultimately why she realized she needed to link up with somebody like Canarchy.
And the doors that Canarchy opens up is more than what she could do on her own. I mean, she was talking about how this is going to open up chain business for her.
Yep.
Three Weavers is 85% draft, which seems insane to me. But if you can build that brand on draft and then move it to chain business, like she said, there's a lot of runway for her ahead.
Yeah, I really did like her comments about, she called them brand impressions. And for her, those brand impressions, at least early on, and really, I mean, kind of still to this day, they occur on premise. And building a brand on premise in today's environment is incredibly difficult. We'll just hit for the trifecta here. It's Brotation Nation out there. I'm gonna steal your lingo, but it is. I mean, it's like you can get a line, and I was having a conversation with somebody the other day. It's like, I have to pay a sales rep in a market that is pretty small to go get a line that then, you know, gets lost after a couple weeks when the bar manager wants to put another beer on. And it seems like that was an area where Three Weavers actually excelled, and they were able to keep their beer on tap. And it was because that was all they had. They weren't focusing on anything else. And so she was able to create a loyal fan base of consumers at the bar, and now it'll be interesting to see what they're able to do off-premise. You know, will all of the work that she put in on-premise lead to some of those chain sales?
It's definitely going to help to have the backing of Canarchy there.
Yeah, I mean, especially in a market like L.A., and we talked a little bit about, you know, just what it's like to sell beer in Los Angeles. I mean, L.A., from all the times that I've been there, is really dominated by Mexican imports and then larger craft brands, both on and off-premise. I mean, you do get your pockets of these, you know, smaller, independent, really niche craft beers. But for the most part, you see a lot of, like, Kona, you see a lot of Golden Road, you see a lot of Firestone, and all of these companies. You see St. Archer places, you see Ballast Point, I mean, Lagunitas, the list sort of goes on. All of them have transacted. All of them have, you know, a ton of resources, and all of them can go in and walk into a Safeway or a Vons or any of these chains that are out there, and they've got an entire team dedicated to those chain sales. So Canarchy will obviously help her with that.
We saw the beginning of what a Canarchy can do for a brand at GABF. They had the biggest display of any craft brewer at GABF.
Yeah.
Three Weavers was prominently featured alongside Oscar Blues, Cigar City, Deep Ellum, and the rest. You know, it's kind of a magical thing when you see it in progress. And how that translates to chain sales, I don't know. But when you're building a foundation like they have on draft, and then you're taking that with the larger entity, it just seems like there's a lot of room to grow.
Well, that was our interview with Lynn Weaver. Great time catching up with her at GABF. And now let's get to some segments.
First up, we have a challenge flag. I'm throwing the challenge flag on cross brewery mix packs. So the Worst Beer blog had a tweet that Costco, they shared a photo. Costco is now selling an Anheuser-Busch mix pack featuring Golden Road, 10 Barrel, and Four Peaks brands. It's a 24-pack. We saw earlier this year, Canarchy has a cross-brewery pack with Cigar City, Perrin, Wasatch, and Oscar Blues. And a few years ago, CBA actually rolled out a mixed pack that had Kona, Red Hook, and Widmer brands in it. Look, these multi-brewery packs are just the modern-day versions of Beers of the World or Beers from Mexico. You know, the packs that you would see collecting dust on a warm shelf inside of a cost-plus World Markets. Inevitably, they're going to end up becoming the Christmas gift that someone's mom buys their son who is getting super into craft beer. And look, more importantly, nobody is asking for this. What I'd like to see is breweries deliver me some more gimmicky multi-packs. Like, I loved Austin Beer Works 99 pack, or there was a Finnish brewery. I'm going to totally butcher the name, but I think it's Nokian Panimo, that literally sold a 1,000 pack of beer, which was basically just a shrink-wrapped pallet. That's the kind of thing I can support.
Yeah, we need more of these. I love the Austin Beer Works 99 pack. I want to see more of that, even though they claimed it was a gigantic mistake. Also, Natty Light just came out with a 77 pack. It's available only in Maryland. This is a beer that is near and dear to my heart. It's the beer that took down the head basketball coach of Iowa State, Larry Eustace. He had to resign in shame after pictures emerged of him with co-eds drinking Natty Light in Missouri.
77 of them?
It might have been 77. We need a 77-pack in Ames, Iowa, so get on that, AB. But I think I need to road trip, too, to get me a 77-pack for myself. Anyone else who wants to do the Wade Boggs Challenge, I would suggest this is a great beer to do it with.
Now, the Wade Boggs Challenge is what you drink a 30-pack in a flight? Is that how it works?
The number, it varies. I think Wade Boggs has said it's anywhere from like 73 to 107.
What?
Yeah.
Now, that is far more ridiculous than what we used to do at when I was in college. We would take the train from Santa Clara to San Francisco. It's like an hour-long ride. And we would do what we call a case race. And you'd have four team members. And you'd try to finish a case of beer in about an hour between four people. Let's just get more high-volume liquid pushing through large multi-packs. No more cross-collaboration, multi-brewery packs, just high-volume packs. Like, 15 packs are cool, but you know what's really cool? A 45-pack. All right, we got one more challenge flag to throw this week. Justin, you're throwing this one on what?
I'm throwing this challenge flag on brewery sports bets. These sports bets are just silly. They're ridiculous. I'm throwing this challenge flag because of you, Miller Coors. Miller Coors bet itself, if you can do that. I guess you can do that.
Yeah.
Miller Coors bet itself in the Brewers-Rockies series. That series is over. Brewers swept the Rockies. It's over. Now Coors has to buy Miller Lights for people in Milwaukee at participating bars on Friday.
So Miller Coors has to buy Miller products for people in Colorado?
No. In Milwaukee.
In Milwaukee.
Yeah.
Okay. Are they buying Coors or are they buying Miller?
Miller Lite.
This is silly. This is why we're throwing the challenge. Like, I don't even know what the bet is. I don't even know what beer they have to buy. I think somebody had a tweet that said, like, this is like betting your wife with a joint bank account. This is ridiculous.
This is ridiculous. All this does, it's free media. Somebody jumps on it and it's like, oh, Miller's betting Coors. We better write a story. We better, you know, get this on TV. No one cares.
Yeah, yeah.
Other than the person getting free beer. And this is the most eye-rolling thing about these is it's always, well, the fans are the real winners.
Yeah, the fans are the real winners. Listen, I got news for you beer companies. The fans are not paying attention to this stuff. I think there's another one. I think Boston Beer or Sam Adams is doing a wager with Brooklyn Brewery, right?
Yep.
What are they wagering?
So the wager in this one is the loser's founder has to toast the winner's team in a video, and they also have to rename a beer in their tap room after the winning team.
Okay, this is stupid. These bets are stupid. Everyone does them. They're not original. Anytime two teams from different cities match up or square off, there's some kind of bet. The loser, like you said, the loser has to pour the other person's beer in the tap room, or they have to dress up in the opposing team's jersey. Like, no more. I want to see a real bet. Like, why don't they actually bet something of value? I want to see breweries bet, like, an entire fermentation tank or a flagship brand. Like, let's see Samuel Adams bet Brooklyn, and I want the stakes to be Brooklyn Lager for Sam 76. Loser has to literally sell that beer for, like, 3 months out in the trade. Or maybe the loser has to pick up the winner's hop contract for an entire quarter. I mean, let's put an actual bet down. Everyone can go to Delaware or New Jersey or whatever other states have legalized sports betting. Lay down a prop bet with one of the bookies there. Like, let's make this happen.
Yeah, instead we get some contrived back and forth on social media that's not real. It's clearly just like some marketing person has put this on, you know. There's no real stakes behind this.
Yeah, tweets vanish, but you know what stings? I'll tell you what stings. Having to pay for 3 months worth of hops, all right? Now, that's a bet. Listen, I got a guy, I know a guy over at DraftKings. I will literally work to make this happen if some brewery wants to take it on. October is here. MLB playoffs still going to be going on. If someone wants to do this challenge, a real challenge, you know where to find us, podcast@brewbound.com. I'll reach out to my dude at DraftKings, and we'll figure out a way.
No one wants this hop contract.
All right, and finally, Justin, you've got a stay woke to close us out for this week. What are you staying woke on?
Yeah, I'm staying woke on beer making the cover of Time magazine. This is a great thing for the industry. This is great timing. All we hear is doom and gloom lately, slowing growth, layoffs, losing market share to wine and spirits, threats from cannabis. And here is beer on the cover of Time magazine.
Oh, how coincidental.
This is why I'm staying woke. Beer, the story of the world's most celebrated drink. Like, I can't even say it without laughing because I love beer. People love beer. It is more than half of total alcohol beverage market share. But this is not like the time and place for this. We've heard so much doom and gloom for so long that this just seems so out of place right now. This seems like the kind of story that you'd be thrilled with if you're a trade association.
I feel like there's always one of these stories that comes around like once every couple of years. I think the New Yorker had one a couple of years ago. And, you know, every major magazine kind of takes a run at doing a feature on beer or, you know, any number of other consumer product goods. But I think you're right. There was a line in there that said, like, beer can be the drink of moderation. Isn't that what the Beer Institute just says all the time? Like, this is the beverage of moderation?
All the time. I feel like I've had my eyeballs wide open and the video goes over and over with beer is the drink of moderation. Beer is the drink of moderation. Beer is the drink of moderation.
Oh my gosh. All right. I mean, I don't know if I can stay completely woke on this, mainly because, I mean, we know how the media business works and we know how publishing works. There's always going to be one of these beer stories, but the timing, I would say, is awfully interesting. If you want to inject a little life into the beer category, what better way to do it than Time magazine, which is, you know, clearly one of the greatest publications of our time.
Not clinging to life or anything.
but there was another part in there that I thought you made a comment about earlier. It was something about a study that they referenced.
Okay, so this is my favorite passage in here, which isn't really the greatest selling point for beer. So they referenced this 2017 British Medical Journal study, and it found that drinkers felt less energized and less sexy than bar patrons who are drinking liquor and wine. They added that beer drinkers, though, and this is the positive, they felt less aggressive and they didn't get sick as much. I'm not sure that that's a selling point for beer. Beer, when you want to feel less sexy and energized than wine and hard liquor drinkers.
Yeah, I'm sure all the Brits felt less sexy. All the Brits in this study felt less sexy because of the beer they were drinking. I'm absolutely positive that it had nothing to do with all the fish and chips, the bangers and mash, the pudding. No. Those are sexy foods, and nothing gets my pistons firing like some bangers and mash and a bowl full of cockles.
Please never say cockles again.
I will do my best to never say cockles again. All right, that is our show for the week. Thank you all for tuning in wherever you're listening. We are available on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, Libsyn, and SoundCloud. If you like what we're doing, leave us a rating and a review. Share the pod with your friends. As always, thank you to our audio team, Josh and Joe, our wonderful guest, Lynn Weaver, and everyone out there in Beer World. Catch us next week for episode 6, which features an interview with Dogfish Head founder Sam Calagione. Until then, cheers.
Cheers.